So that's something special.
From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, picking up the pieces after the Kenya attack. Nigerian refugees in Cameroon place great hope in Buhari. The Houthis continuing advances in southern Yemen, plus Muslims chosen to build a special chair for the Pope. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. The Kenyan Interior Ministry Sunday said one of the Al-Shabaab attackers responsible for killing nearly 150 people at the Garissa University College Thursday was the son of a government official. The son, identified as Abdirahim Abdullahi, was one of four mass gunmen who attacked the campus in the country's northeast, about 200 kilometers from the Somali border. All four gunmen were killed in the security force response. On Saturday, Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta warned the planners and financiers of such attacks that they're deeply embedded in society and called on Muslims to do more to fight radicalization. Daniel Bekele of Human Rights Watch told VOA's Victor Beatty the government statement underscores the success groups like Al-Shabaab are having in their recruitment efforts.
Al-Shabaab has been recruiting from Kenya not only ethnic Somalis, but also ethnic Somali Kenyans, as we have seen in some of Al-Shabaab propaganda videos. I'm not sure whether or not recent news about one of the attackers being a son of a local government official is necessarily a sign how Al-Shabaab is embedded in Kenyan government authorities, but it is certainly a sign how much Al-Shabaab is recruiting from Kenya.
Is Al-Shabaab now changing its tactics, similar to what Boko Haram is doing in Nigeria, attacking schools?
It has been doing this for a long time now, actually. So this is not the first time when Al-Shabaab has attacked civilians or schools, students, hospitals, shopping malls, whether in Kenya or Somalia. You know, this is something they have repeatedly been doing, which is a terrible murderous attack against civilians, whether in Kenya or Somalia. It has been happening repeatedly. Perhaps the world media attention has come to know of the bigger attacks, but there have also been smaller attacks, particularly in northeastern Kenya and Somalia, targeting civilians, particularly students, including women and girls, which is a terrible, despicable attack.
President Obama plans to visit Nairobi in July in a phone call to his Kenyan counterpart, Uhuru Kenyatta. Mr. Obama last week late said that the two leaders will discuss how to strengthen counterterrorism cooperation and work together to build a safer, more prosperous future for Kenya and the broader region. Does Kenya need help given the criticism it's come under for the delay in response, security response to this attack?
Yeah, I believe Kenya needs all the help it can get in terms of strengthening its security responses. But I think Kenya equally needs strengthening its response in terms of compliance with rule of law and human rights. Some of the security responses that we have seen in the past were marred by serious human rights abuses, including extrajudicial execution, arbitrary detention, torture, and so on. You know, so I think this seems to, unfortunately, to fuel the crisis situation, as well as pushing some people into militancy, particularly from some of the disadvantaged population. So what is key in terms of the strengthening the response is respect for human rights and respect for rule of law.
The April 2nd attack was the worst to hit Kenya since the 1998 bombing of the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi, which killed 213 people. Washington says Al-Shabaab poses a serious threat to Kenya, and it remains in touch with Kenyan authorities and is providing security assistance, including training and equipment. On Saturday, Al-Shabaab issued a statement threatening what they called another bloodbath in Kenya. The group said last week's attack was revenge for Kenyan military action inside of Somalia. In Egypt, a bomb on a Cairo bridge Sunday killed a policeman and wounded at least two other people. The extremist group Ajnam Misr, or Soldiers of Egypt, claim responsibility for the explosion on the 15th of May bridge. The group, which first emerged last year, is blamed for repeated attacks on security forces in and around Cairo. Egyptian security forces also say they have killed the leader and founder of the same militant group in a shootout at a Cairo apartment. Haman Mohamed Atiyah was shot dead during a firefight in a residential neighborhood. Unknown assailants launched rockets on the northern Mali town of Gao on Sunday, killing at least one person, wounding three others in that incident. There was no immediate claim of responsibility. The UN mission condemned what it called the terrorist attack on innocent civilians. Mali's desert north has endured frequent assaults by Islamist militants, despite a French-led drive to oust fighters in 2013. Tuareg separatists tried to take control of the territory following a military coup that was back in 2012, but their rebellion was taken over by Al-Qaeda-linked groups. Also in the news, Central and Western African leaders are expected to meet this week in the capital of Equatorial Guinea, Malabo, to update their efforts to join the defeat the militant Islamic group Boko Haram. The talks on Wednesday are organized by the Economic Community of West African States and the Economic Community of Central African States. An ECOWAS statement says the meeting comes in the face of the mounting, increasing bloodly attacks on the fundamentalists against Nigeria, as well as Niger, Cameroon, and in Chad. The meeting comes in the wake of the election of Nigerian president-elect Muhammadu Buhari. An election seen partly as a repudiation of incumbent President Goodluck Jonathan's inability to take on the insurgency, which the UN has said has left 15,000 people dead since 2009. Well, many Nigerian refugees now living in Cameroon say they expect Buhari to end the Boko Haram insurgency soon after he takes office so they can return home. Cameroon is host to some 200,000 Nigerians who fled Boko Haram terrorist attacks. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports these Nigerians did not have an opportunity to vote in the March 28 elections, but have great hopes for the future.
42-year-old Chidi Lucas fled violence in the northeastern Nigerian town of Ngoshe in the middle of last year and is now an electronic repairman in Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé. He regrets he didn't get to vote, but says he accepts the outcome even though his candidate, President Goodluck Jonathan, was defeated.
He has done a lot in Nigeria, like in good roads, many things, improvement. Nigeria came out as the first economic country in Africa. We have never been in that position since. Since Goodluck Jonathan took power in Nigeria, there's no first class city in Nigeria. But it is democracy. Buhari has taken over. We support him. Even Goodluck Jonathan has already congratulated him.
Chidi says Mr. Jonathan lost votes because of his inability to stop 6 years of Boko Haram terrorism. He says his wish now is for his successor, Muhammadu Buhari, to capitalize on the recent gains made by the new regional military force deployed against Boko Haram and bring back home people like him who want to participate in the development of their country.
Boko Haram has been in Nigeria since. Cameroon government, Chadian government, and Niger government put hand in fighting Boko Haram. That is why there is progress in fighting them. As Buhari is taking over now, he will continue where Goodluck Jonathan has left. The Boko Harams have no power again as they have before.
For others, the thought of going home is too painful. Aissatou Jowell, a 32-year-old refugee from Gwoza, says even if Buhari does manage to eradicate Boko Haram, she is too traumatized to return. She says her husband was killed in front of their children for refusing to give money to Boko Haram fighters, and to go back, the memories will be unbearable. But she hopes that Boko Haram massacres will be ended so that others will not have to experience her pain. Emmanuel Odimere, who has taken in three relatives who fled Boko Haram fighting, says she will be watching for Mr. Buhari to keep his promises.
It was God's will that Buhari should win. What I expect of him is a peaceful Nigeria and not trying to Islamize the whole country. You know, since Buhari said if he climbs, Boko Haram will stop, we're expecting that from him. Since he has given his word that he can do so, let him show his capacity.
Cameroon-born political analyst Professor Ngolengole Elvis says Nigerians see their future in Buhari's hands.
But what matters here is that Buhari have to know that many Nigerians would want to be seen as a people, the number one country in Africa, the number one economy. They should fight the Boko Haram insurgency. In fact, Muhammadu Buhari understand that in Africa, if they fail, they have failed Africa. And I think Nigerians would like to go down as the shining light of Africa, the torchlight of Africa. And I believe that this time around, they will do it.
Muhammadu Buhari will be inaugurated on May 29th with the world watching. Beginning May 30th, his people will be watching with great expectations. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaounde.
It was reported Sunday that at least four people were killed, 20 others wounded by a suicide bomb attack on Saturday on a security checkpoint near the western city of Misrata, a power base for the Libyan Dawn Islamist Militia Alliance, which took over the capital Tripoli last year, set up a rival government to challenge the internationally recognized administration of Prime Minister Abdullah Athini in the country's east. Italian Navy and Coast Guard ships announced Sunday they had picked up about 1,500 migrants at sea during a 24-hour period on Saturday after receiving distress calls from three of the migrant vessels off the Libyan coast. They were transported to Sicily or Lampedusa. Number of illegal migrants entering the European Union last year ranged from 170,000 to 276,000, most from the Mediterranean. More than 3,000 perished in an attempt to cross the Mediterranean in 2014. Number of arrivals has soared in the first few months of this year.
VOA Special English, a way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
And continuing here on the Voice of America, scattered pockets of fighting continued around the southern Yemeni capital of Aden as Houthi militants tried to advance along various fronts. Edward Uranian is following the story.
Amateur video shows Houthi militants showing a residential district in the southern Yemeni capital of Aden as fighters loyal to President Abdrabu Mansour Hadi return fire with light weapons. What appeared to be Houthi field artillery sporadically shelled people trying to flee Aden. Houthi tanks attempted to advance into Aden from the north despite resistance from local fighters. It was not immediately clear how much territory the Houthis control. The Houthis Al Masira TV showed video of the port region of Aden claiming the group controls the area. A young Houthi fighter in a military uniform insisted his unit is advancing.
تتقدم هذه الدبابة مع أفراد القوات المسلحة والأمن للذهاب لإكمال تطهير محافظة عدن وإكمال تطهير.
He says Houthi tanks are ready to move on the nearby district of Makala, which he says is the scene of heavy fighting. Arab media reported tribal fighters from the eastern province of Hadramaut are also trying to move on Makala from the east to try to dislodge Al-Qaeda fighters who control the district. The Houthis appear to be attempting to advance from the west. Al Arabiya TV indicates the Saudi-led coalition battling to push back the Houthis launched airstrikes along various routes to try to cut Houthi supply lines. Houthi TV reported several strikes hit the region between Shabwa and Baida provinces. Saudi military spokesman General Ahmed Asiri indicated coalition planes bombed Miyom Island near the Bab el-Mandeb Strait leading to the Red Sea.
قامت قوات التحالف خلال ليلة البارحة باستهداف جزيرة ميون ولتظهر سوف أظهر لكم أولا على الخارطة حتى تكون واضحة.
He says that coalition warplanes bombed tanks, weapons and ammunition on the island, which were posing a threat to international shipping lanes through the Bab el-Mandeb. French government-owned Radio Monte Carlo in Arabic reported Saudi Special Forces troops were participating in the fighting inside Yemen. But Saudi sources denied the reports, saying that it was premature to talk about any ground attack. A Russian-sponsored resolution in the UN Security Council calling for a humanitarian pause in the fighting in Yemen met strong criticism from supporters of the Saudi-led coalition. Yemeni acting Foreign Minister Riyad Yassin called the motion biased, claiming the Russians are hoping to use a ceasefire to resupply the Houthis with arms. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
And while the United Nations considers that Russian-sponsored resolution to allow humanitarian aid into Yemen, the International Committee of the Red Cross says there are positive developments in its appeal to Yemen's warring parties to allow desperately needed medical supplies into the country. Lisa Schlein reports from ICRC headquarters in Geneva.
The Red Cross is calling on the warring parties in Yemen to stop fighting for at least 24 hours so it can bring urgently needed medical supplies into the country. ICRC spokeswoman for the Near Middle East, Sitara Jabin, says there are hopeful signs this humanitarian pause will go into effect. She tells VOA the ICRC is just waiting for the green light to go ahead with the operation.
Right now we have more than 48 tons of medical supplies that we want to send to the country because this is what the hospitals need the most right now. Then we have a surgical team, a four-member surgical team that we want to bring to Aden so that this team can work and treat the people who need treatment so urgently because the local hospitals are inundated with patients.
The Red Cross describes the situation in Yemen as dire. It says much of Yemen is running low on life-saving medicines and equipment. In some parts of the country, it says people are suffering from fuel and water shortages and food stocks are running out. It says dozens of people are being killed and wounded every day, and the streets of Aden are strewn with bodies. UN Relief Coordinator Valerie Amos on Thursday reported 519 people have been killed and nearly 1,700 wounded in fighting during the past 2 weeks. Airstrikes by the Saudi-led military coalition against the rebel Houthis began about 10 days ago. Among the dead are three Yemeni Red Cross volunteers who lost their lives in targeted attacks in the last week while helping people wounded in the fighting. Jabin says the people of Yemen will suffer even more than they already are if aid workers cannot do their jobs safely.
The consequences will be that the people who are now literally depending on this aid, some of them are dying already in many parts of the country, those who cannot reach hospitals or who cannot get treatment. Some of the hospitals have closed down because of the situation. And if this continue, then unfortunately many more people will die.
Jabin says the 48 tons of medicine and surgical kits it hopes to send to Yemen will be enough to treat 2,000 to 3,000 people. She says planes in Jordan and Geneva are ready to leave for Yemen as soon as they get formal clearance. She says the ICRC also is ready to send tents, generators and supplies to repair the damaged water network. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Christians around the world celebrated Easter Sunday, marking the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Robert Berger attended festivities in Jerusalem.
Thy be the celebrations began in Jerusalem with a sunrise service at the Garden Tomb. Pilgrims sang hymns of the resurrection in the scenic garden, which resembles the place where Jesus was buried according to biblical accounts. Facing an empty tomb carved into a rock, they proclaimed that Jesus is risen. It was a more solemn service at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in the Old City. Priests and monks in festive robes chanted the Easter liturgy in front of the ancient stone tomb, revered by Christians as the place where Jesus rose from the dead. A cloud of fragrant incense floated into a golden rotunda, depicting a burst of light and the splendor of the resurrection. Pilgrims came from all over the world.
I've had an amazing spiritual experience here in Jerusalem as the place that Christ chose to come.
Rick Keller is from Atlanta, Georgia, in the United States.
There's a sense of connection here that is much greater than maybe a lot of places in the world. I think that there is a spirit about this city.
Shirley Relosa came from Manila in the Philippines.
It's a good feeling being here. It's divine and magical. The atmosphere is good, very peaceful. Everybody is smiling. Everybody is inviting.
Jerusalem is packed with both Christian and Jewish pilgrims as Easter coincides this year with the week-long biblical holiday of Passover. Christians believe Jesus Christ is the Son of God and was resurrected from the dead in order to grant eternal life and forgiveness of worldly sins to his followers. Robert Berger for VOA News in Jerusalem's Old City.
Catholic Church in Bosnia-Herzegovina has chosen a Muslim family of wood carvers to build a chair that Pope Francis will use during a visit to the country in June. Traditionally, Bosnians do make a new chair for every pope who comes to visit, but the honor has never been granted to a Muslim craftsman. That story now from VOA's Zlatica Hoc.
The Hajdarovac family from the town of Zavidovici in northeastern Bosnia is famous in the region for carving wooden objects for everyday use as well as religious symbols for Muslims, Catholics, and Orthodox Christians. The family tradition started 50 years ago with Suleiman Hajdarovac, whose son Salim took over after his death and passed the skills on to his son Edin. When Salim learned in February that the Pope will visit Bosnia, he contacted the local Catholic church and offered to build a chair for the pontiff. The proposal was forwarded to the church leaders in Sarajevo.
They invited us to talk and we reached an agreement. After the formal procedure was over, we started making this chair. I am extremely happy that we got the project because making a chair for such an important person is a huge deal.
The cost of the chair will be covered by private donations by members of the Zavidovici parish and the Hajdarovac family.
I had a discussion with my flock, and it was difficult at the beginning because people are struggling financially. But once they understood that it is about the Pope, the Catholic leader of the world, but who is coming here also as a political leader of the world, then people said, let's go, we will support this.
The family has agreed not to reveal the cost of making the chair.
It will be an honor for me and my family to build a chair for the Holy Father Francis.
What Edin Hajdarovac will say is that the chair is being made of walnut. Pope Francis will sit on it during a mass on June 6th in Bosnia's capital, Sarajevo. About 100,000 people are expected to attend. The parish priest, meanwhile, hopes the chair will make history.
With this, the Zavidovici parish will enter the history of Bosnia, and in a way, the history of the Catholic Church, and in the end, the history of the world.
The Hajdarovac family has put off all other orders to finish the chair by the end of May, when it has to be delivered to Sarajevo. Zlatica Hoc, VOA News, Washington.
Tiger Woods has ended all the speculation about his game when he announced Friday that he will play in this week's prestigious Masters Golf Tournament, U.S. State of Georgia. Golf's biggest attraction and four-time Masters champion played two practice rounds at Augusta National this past week before a simple announcement on his website that he would end his two-month leave on the sport's biggest stage. Woods hasn't won a tournament since August 2013. In all, he has won 14 majors, including four Masters, the second all-time winner behind Jack Nicklaus. And for those of you following the U.S. Basketball Championships, it's down now to two teams, Duke University and the University of Wisconsin. They'll play for the title later today in Indianapolis, Indiana. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in to the Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. A reminder, the top world news is straight ahead. We hope you'll stay tuned for that. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Aiden Utku, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Monday.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on the Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Department of State in early March recognized 10 women from around the globe with the Secretary of State's International Women of Courage Award. They were honored for their outstanding contributions to peace, human rights, gender equality, and social progress. If we are to address and meet our most pressing global challenges, we must include women and girls, Deputy Secretary of State for Management and Resources Heather Higginbottom said during the ceremony. But too often, women have no voice in the political process or access to the halls of justice. Still, the voices of many are difficult to ignore. To amplify women's voices, three of the awardees formed advocacy groups. Maysaba Pugh is the director of the Gender Equality Network in Burma, a coalition of some 90 organizations collaborating to advocate for women's rights. She has been instrumental in developing Burma's inaugural National Strategic Plan for the Advancement of Women. After an outbreak of violence in Burma's Kachin State in 2011, Ms. May co-founded the Kachin Peace Network and the Kachin Women's Peace Network to raise awareness of internally displaced persons, of specific needs of displaced women, and to advocate for peace and reconciliation in Burma. Sayaka Osakabe sparked a nationwide conversation about discrimination against women in the Japanese workforce through an organization she founded, Matahara Net. One of the women she helped won a landmark Japan Supreme Court case in October 2014, ruling against pregnancy discrimination. Ms. Osakabe has advocated strongly, and the government of Japan has taken commendable policy steps to address the issue. Rosa Julieta Montaño Salvatierra of Bolivia has spent much of her life working towards protecting women's rights and to protect women from sexual exploitation and violence. 30 years ago, she founded the NGO Oficina Jurídica para la Mujer, or Legal Office for Women, which promotes gender equality through education and by influencing public policy. The organization has worked with the Bolivian legislature in drafting laws that help or protect women, such as stricter penalties for rape, greater protection for reproductive rights, and advanced gender equality laws. These honorees demonstrate to us what is possible when women stand up for their rights and freedoms, said Deputy Secretary Higginbottom. But they also demonstrate that we have a long road still to travel to achieve justice and equality for all.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.